Hello, welcome back to The Periphery from the Pulaski Institution. I'm Alan Elrod, and today's guest is Dr. Kristen Lunds-Trujillo from the University of South Carolina. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science there, and her area of specialty is rural studies. And so I'm really excited to have her on. You may have already guessed just from that intro that we're going to be talking a little bit about the White Rural Rage book that's been driving discourse up and down TV and podcasting and think pieces for a little bit now. But before we do, I thought it would be helpful, you know, Kristen, this may interest you as well, mm-hmm. which is I grew up in a place that I think helps illuminate for people maybe the question that you guys have when you're doing rural research of what really is rural, which is the hometown that I'm originally from is just outside of the Little Rock Metro. It's included in the combined statistical area. It's not in the metropolitan statistical area. When I was a baby, there was about 15, 13,000 people there. By the time I graduated college, it was about 20-something thousand. And it's a micropolitan. It's called Searcy. It's about 45-minute drive, 50-minute drive from Searcy to the riverfront where Little Rock and North Little Rock meet.
Okay.
And it fits probably a lot of the, you know, you leave our town and you get rural real fast, or you can head southwest towards Little Rock and it continues to build up along the way. And I think that's a good place to start with in terms of asking. Obviously, people have in their head ideas of what rural is. But as a researcher, when you're having to actually work with more defined categories and you're trying to measure things and ask questions and get data, what are the boundaries of rural versus not even just urban, but this kind of the levels that go between that?
Sure. So that's a great question. And a lot of people across different disciplines, like academic disciplines, across different, you know, government departments and elsewhere, have grappled with this question, and there's no consensus. So there are over 70 official designations for urban rural in the United States alone. And I mean, there's a general clustering of what we think of usually. So a lot of those official designations use like some form of population density combined with many of them use commuting area as well. So how close are you to those like dense clusters? And so that's one that's commonly used. The rural urban commuting area codes by the USDA uses that designation. And then there are differences in how do we measure suburb? That's a big one too. At what point is it a metropolitan center, you know, like urban versus suburban? There's questions of what's micropolitan. So where is the population cutoff? And then there's a question too of, you know, like a smaller metropolitan area versus a large metropolitan area are going to have suburbs. And those are going to be like, they're going to look pretty different. And then you have, of course, even small towns, you know, a small town, kind of what you were describing-ish where you grew up, but then that was sort of micropolitan. Well, so there's a good illustration of the difference in, you know, how many people, but also how close are you to, you know, Little Rock or wherever else you're comparing. So then there's a lot of complexity there. Absolutely. And there's not a good consensus a lot of times on what rural is, which is why it's so important when you're talking about rural, at least in an academic, your research oriented context, you need to really clarify what you're using, you know, what, how you conceptualize of what it is. And aside from those official definitions, there's also a way to understand rural that's just self-defined. You ask someone, you know, in the area that you live, what is it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. You know, I'm from that, this kind of place you're describing. And, you know, I had friends who lived down on farms out in the county, and I'm a city boy to them.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone from even just like Little Rock, Arkansas is not a high population, about 3 million people. And so despite the fact that Little Rock is not a big city, it's about 200 something thousand in the city proper, about 700 plus thousand in the metro. I think maybe it hit 800,000 at this point.
Sure.
But my hometown was also a college town, so there was that dynamic. The main hospital for the kind of county area was there, so there was some affluence associated with that. But, you know, anybody even just from Little Rock would have seen me as from a tiny town, or a small town at least, not a big place. And certainly anyone from a much bigger city like Dallas, or, you know, my wife is from Fort Worth. And so it's, you know, growing up, I was like, I'm not really a country kid, right? But then I would go other places and describe my hometown, and they would be like, you live in a, like, you may as well live in an intersection with a stop sign. Like, and right. So, you know, that dynamic is fascinating to me, where it's like, when I was really growing up, I didn't think of myself as like a country kid. And then I was like, oh, I kind of am. Cause then I went to grad school in New York City, and no one could comprehend like the kind of town I was from.
Yeah.
Or knew where it was, right? I just had to tell people I was from Little Rock because no one had a clue. Yeah. But that self-definition aspect, I think, especially when we start talking about the White Rural Rage book, I think is also really important, because like there are people who just don't think of themselves as rural, or who look at someone else and say, well, I'm not rural. That person's rural. Because that's what I did. I would be like, I'm not from a small town. A small town is like, there was a town called Romance that my friend was from that was basically like a gas station. And I was like, that's a small town. Like, I'm not from a small town. You know, like, I'm from a reasonably sized town. They're from a small town. And then people would be like, no, you're from a small town. And so that sense, that relative way that we think about ourselves is also really fascinating to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it varies a lot by region too, or state. So you kind of picked up on that a little bit as well. So, I mean, I lived for 1 year in Rhode Island, which according to almost every single category, official designation, rural Rhode Island doesn't really exist. But I mean, there are areas where I grew up in rural Minnesota, and it's sort of the opposite, where like every single designation says that, yeah, that's a rural county. But like there were places there that I would have classified as rural, which also kind of gets at another measurement issue too, of, you know, a lot of these designations use like county or zip code area. Mm-hmm. You know, a county can encompass a metropolitan center and a rural area is also the issue there too. So okay. I think like Dane County in Wisconsin, which is where Madison is, you have a metropolitan center, capital of the state, all the way down to small towns and like farms. So it's absolutely, you know, relative. And it's also, you know, beyond that sort of self-classification, even some of those measures that are official, they're not fine-grained enough a lot of times to really capture those differences as well.
And my wife and I always joke, like, there's this like kind of aesthetic aspect too, where like, because a lot of the suburb I'm in now is on the southwest side of Little Rock, and I'm only like a minute or two from the actual city limits of Little Rock. And then there's a big shopping center and everything like that. And then my town is not the farthest reach. There's another main sort of suburban town a little bit to our southwest. But the boundaries are strange, right? Like my neighborhood is like only like 5 to 10 minutes from this like shopping center that's in Little Rock proper. But if I turn the other direction out of it in about 2 minutes, I'm on county roads.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this thing that we love to kind of joke about, which is like a phenomenon, I think, in places, probably especially in like the New South, where urbanization and suburbanization density came a little later. You'll just be like driving, and there will be all these kind of markers of like new development and, you know, shopping center stuff. And then there'll just be like a farm that someone, I guess, like refused to sell in the middle of town with like a barbed wire fence. And you're like, okay, this is just like an old barn and a farm that I guess like is just here because no one could do anything. And the development just had to go around it.
Yeah. Yeah. That I encountered that too outside of Columbia as well. In fact, I kind of live near one of those places, which gets at another element of measuring rural, which is this rural identity. Mm-hmm. So you pointed out, you're pointing out that there's been change over time. So you have places that used to be rural and then developed because they're close enough to an urban center where they became suburbs, or exurbs, or whatever term you want to use. And so a lot of times people who grew up there and saw all these changes, you know, the person who's a holdout, like holdout farm with all these developments, they're going to still say they're rural, you know, very likely.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's almost a matter of identity. It is a matter of identity that even though, my area is clearly developing. Like I'm here as a farmer, on a farm or whatever else. And so there's also that sort of element of like things have changed over time and that people socialized into a certain circumstance, you know, area. And then even though things change around them, their identity might still stay that way. Or conversely, people might have grown up in a rural area and left, but still might sort of identify as being a rural person. So there's also not just that sort of subjective looking around and thinking, yeah, this place kind of has the markers of rural, you know, in my opinion, which is sort of what you're getting at in the beginning. But also this idea that there's a sociocultural definition of rural that's sort of semi-divorced from place. And so that's actually some of the research I work on as well. But yeah, there are all these different complex pieces in terms of, you know, how rural can be defined. Does it look rural? That's a good one that you brought up. Mm-hmm. Another one that sometimes talked about is like, you know, how agricultural is it, or how, like, how many, you know, trees is it, like sort of the remoteness in quotations. That's a lot of times another sort of element that people use to try to describe or understand what rural is.
That leads me to, because this is an intersection, I think, of something that's quite measurable with these kinds of sociocultural, how we kind of hold imaginations in our head, which is affluence. I mean, I think a lot of people have a notion of certain rural areas as very dilapidated, sometimes in a romantic way. They have a kind of Southern Gothic thing about it, right? But if you're from these areas, you also know there's some big houses out in the country. Like,
oh yeah,
big, nice house. Like, and land is like, it's, you know, it might be cheaper in a certain state than other places, but it's like owning land is still something that you'd only get to do if you have a certain level of financial comfort. That's a really interesting thing to me, because, you know, there's that, to me, that gets at that, like, there's data there, and I'd be interested to know a little bit about how that maybe changes in different places from you. And I think also this kind of is a good setup for jumping into the book, which is, you know, when we talk about rural places being left behind, we can mean the economy. We can mean places that have been suffered from underinvestment or from job loss and brain. And those things are real in plenty of places. But we don't always have to mean economically. It can just be more of a sense that they're ignored, even if they're actually quite wealthy people. And so I think that dynamic and that difference between people who do feel truly sort of economically adrift and then people who feel more dislocated in a political and cultural sense but are perfectly comfortable is an interesting distinction to be able to draw.
Yeah, so there's a number of things you touched on that I find interesting. So first of all, to the first part of what you were talking about with this idea of rural and class. So there is a huge confound between understanding rural as working class, a massive one in, I would say, definitely in popular culture, definitely in news, even reporting on politics. There's an assumption that if you talk to someone in the Ohio diner in like a small town, that they're working class. But there are a lot of people in rural America who are not. There's a substantial middle class. There are rich people in rural America. Sometimes you can get at that by sector, but even then, that's not a very good way to think about it. So if you think like, oh, this is someone who works in agriculture, so they must be working class. Well, no, they could be very poor and be, you know, a farmhand who's the temporary worker, like picking fruit off trees, all the way up to you own a big agribusiness. You know, that's a whole spectrum. And a lot of times, all of these people will live in a rural area. So I think. And then alongside that, you know, if you think about the Northeast and you think about the Mountain West, are two places where a lot of rich people will retire to or buy a second home. And, you know, it's sometimes causing problems in the local area there. It's almost like a gentrification happening where the rents and the housing prices rise and then everything else, the cost of living for everything else rises up. But that, again, sort of overturns that notion of that, you know, rural means working class. I mean, even where I live, again, it's an exurb, but a lot of the more rural parts of where I live, if we want to think of it that way, I mean, they have like horses with nice houses. So it's, and then thinking too, a lot of times, I think even among like other places, so where I grew up, it was very heavily agricultural. The county I grew up in was, at least at one point in time, this is still pretty prevalent, but it was one of the biggest pork producing counties in the United States. And so you'd have multimillionaires on hog farms. And if you talk to them, or if you see them, you know, in the local small town, they look like everyone else. Like, they're not like, you know, they're not like wearing suits with like top hats and monocles, you know,
They're not going to build it age on people.
They have Carhartt jackets on, like they have their boots on. Yeah.
The king of this kind of thing, right? Look, the University of Arkansas just got John Calipari to come be our basketball coach, and they took the Tyson jet to go get him because there's some serious cash in Northwest Arkansas. It's cash, though, that's associated with things that we see maybe as more blue collar industries, poultry, it's Walmart, but it's still crazy money, right? I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's this perception that, oh, these people must be like the working class. It's like, no, you know, maybe they don't look like, you know, maybe their lifestyles and choices and things like that of a like millionaire living in rural America might be different than a millionaire living, you know, in a city. But like to say that that's a class-based difference is like not quite right.
Maybe not so much.
Right. And so, yeah, I'm actually working on some preliminary research, sort of looking at, I'm actually working on a book project that looks at this, you know, breaking apart class in rural America, because it's a lot of times so confounded. On the other part, and that's sort of what you were talking about with the rural left behind, I think that's a really important distinction, thinking that we always think it's economic left behind. But there are other ways that people feel left behind. And so some like groundbreaking research in the field that I work in is a book by Catherine Kramer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she wrote a book called The Politics of Resentment, where she goes into rural communities in Wisconsin in like the late 2000s, early 2010s, and interviews people with the question, why do you vote against your interests, which is a common question people tend to pose with rural Americans, especially white rural Americans. And then also that project then sort of evolved into, why are you supporting Scott Walker, who is an anti-establishment politician? And she found that, well, there was these sort of set of grievances that people tended to have in the people she interviewed. And it was that they feel, you know, there was the economic part. We feel economically disadvantaged compared to urban centers, which sort of goes along with that broader narrative. It goes along with the decline in like the dairy industry in Wisconsin, decline in manufacturing. Even with corn and soybeans, that's gone down all sort of important places, important sectors in Wisconsin. But then she also said there are two other grievances that people talked about quite a bit. The second one is that rural people are disrespected in society. So there's this issue of status and feeling like they're looked down on. And so that kind of maybe segueing into the White Rural Rage book.
It does.
That's sort of replicated in a lot of different places.
My story about this is always that I tell people is always I grew up in Arkansas. I went to college, an undergrad in Arkansas, and then I went to grad school at NYU. Yeah. Was that some sort of drinks thing with people? And, you know, a lot of people, you know, this is common, a lot of people and then their friends in a city like New York at a school like NYU had much fancier pedigrees than me, right? They came from Ivy colleges and things like that, and Ivy adjacent places like NYU or, you know, those sorts of places. And I remember talking to someone, and this was a person with like multiple Ivy degrees, and they were just where, and they said, "Where is Arkansas?" And I just thought, you know, this is not a dumb person. This is a smart person. And I don't know where my state is. And it really was like a disorient. It was a moment for me where I was like, oh, I'm from nowhere. Like, and you can't like unring that bell, right? Yeah. Like, it wasn't like, and they weren't asking in a rude way. They weren't being a jerk. They genuinely didn't know. And that was almost made it worse because it was like, man, like, I'm from somewhere that you can't even place on the map, and it's part of your country.
Yeah.
I like, you know, granted, I was like a nerd geography kid and stuff growing up. So like, maybe I knew a little bit more about like where places were, you know, like the average person in Arkansas probably couldn't place Albany on a map.
Sure.
Or something, but they know, but like, they generally know where New York is. Right.
Right.
And the idea that someone would just be like, I don't have a clue where Arkansas is. What is it?
And it's Ivy League. Person.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You'd expect them to be more informed about
right
it.
Right.
It was
a really like it has never left me because it was just such a, and there was an emotional aspect of it to my head that was like, oh, where I'm from means nothing. And it was
all hard,
it wasn't what was being that's not what they were saying to me, but that's what I felt.
Yeah It's like the world, you know. The flyover country, it's even the name, it's just like, it doesn't matter. It's all this stuff that doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And you see that even, like, you see this confounded, too, like, with states. People will be like, oh, you know, we're going to talk about Kansas. And there's an assumption that that's all rural and there's, like, no cities, which is not true. Yeah. Even Minnesota, that's happened. And it's like, well, Minneapolis isn't a small, like, the Twin Cities are not a small place. Yeah.
No, they're not. You know, we don't have a huge city here, but we have built up areas that are right. Urban and have right. Stuff, you know, and all the things that come with being urban.
Yeah, it's like a developed place.
Right. It's like, they're like, I'm like, what, do you think I live like, just like, we all just live adjacent to like a cow farm? Like, I mean, like, no. Yeah. And I mean, like, yeah, it was a really tough, like, and then, like I said, it made it worse because, and this is the thing I think that's hard to get at with some of this stuff is, it wasn't malicious. I, in a way, maybe I was being looked down on, but not consciously, not in a way that was intending to communicate that right. Where I was from didn't matter. It was just, they didn't have to be said. Because if it mattered, you'd know where it was.
Right. Yeah. So that's a great example of yeah. This. And I know, you know, obviously that sort of state, but again, people confound those things like, oh, the more rural states, relatively, mm-hmm. Or the less, you know, the ones that aren't on the coasts. You know, that all tends to get lumped together just as, oh, it must be all the same.
Right.
And
right.
It's not. I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, you know, I don't need to.
No, I think it's fun. Yeah. But so, okay. Now it gives us a chance to talk about, because I wasn't angry. That's actually not the feeling I felt. I mean, I felt a tiny tinge of resentment. I'll say that. It did put a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. But let's talk about white rural rage, the threat to American democracy by Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman. You actually have a piece out in Newsweek from earlier this spring entitled White Rural Rage Cites My Research. It gets everything wrong about rural. It gets everything about rural America wrong. So let's get into it. The thesis of this book, the thesis is on the cover, right? Which is that rural America, predominantly white rural America, is angry. And it's angry for a set of reasons that have to do with economic and racial resentments. And this anger means that there is a less commitment to democracy, more openness to political violence, all things that are very, in the broad sense, real and measurable changes that have happened in the American population. There is the American population, generally speaking, is seeing a rise in some of these anti-democratic attitudes and deliberalisms, right? Real problems. They're not identifying problems that don't exist, but they are locating it very specifically in the white rural community.
Yeah.
And they cite you, and you have this Newsweek. So let's start with your Newsweek piece, I guess, and a little bit of the objection you take to your work that's used in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So so at the outset, you know, I was not the first person or the first political scientist working in rural politics to criticize this book. The first that I saw was by Nick Jacobs, and then another piece by Nick Jacobs and Cal Moonis. And they talk about just blatant misuse misciting research, for example, that claim that rural Americans are more violent or more supportive of violence, rather. They make that claim. They cite Cal's work. And Cal's work said the opposite, that rural Americans are not more likely to support political violence. So that type of thing happens often in that book. And then since I wrote my piece, there was a big article in The Atlantic, I think like a week ago, by Tyler Austin Harper, that gets into this a lot more, that just a lot of times.
Tyler's piece is very good.
It was very good. It was very well researched. A lot of times the authors would cite something, you know, a statement, say, you know, about sheriffs, about political violence. And then the cited study didn't even talk about the thing that they were referencing. Also with the political violence piece, they cited it was a report by Pape saying that Trump supporters, the article, you know, the original source said that the January 6th participants, they were actually more from urban areas that Biden won, but they were, you know, Trump supporters. So there was a sort of disaffection happening, especially in like suburban areas where there was historically white flight. Well, that was like a clear one. And then
I do want to hop into that point real fast, because this is something when we first launched this podcast that Dr. Heather Gates at UCA and I talked about, which is this notion of, we were talking about this at the beginning of this podcast, about the distinction between genuine kind of economic anxiety where you really are losing your money and you're poor and you're struggling, and what is a more relative kind of anxiety and resentment that has to do with maybe a sense of being brushed aside or kind of very relative status loss things. Yeah. And I think that really gets at that dynamic. These people who live in these places where they themselves are not necessarily doing badly, but they feel surrounded by people that they don't like or don't trust. Exactly. And maybe even feel, because of this change, that their own status in these places has diminished.
Yeah, there's a feeling of threat. Absolutely. Whether it's a direct sort of status with, you know, racial changes happening. There's political science research finding that it's not the, this is with immigration, but it's sort of applicable in some ways. It's not necessarily so much the number of immigrants that might determine, you know, harsher or stricter attitudes towards immigration. It's actually, are you living in a place that's relatively, you know, exploded in terms of number of immigrants recently? So it's that change that really, really can spark people. And change their attitudes when it comes to sort of context, looking at contextual cues. So, yeah, I mean, very much that that's what this, you know, this report on January 6th concluded. But then White Rural Rage, the authors there cited this piece and said it was white which wasn't the case. And even in that Austin Harper piece in The Atlantic, he actually interviewed the author of that original piece and said that the author was like, no, they completely misinterpreted my results. So these are just all examples. I could keep going. I started my article, you know, saying that because a lot of the conclusions made in this book were not carefully done, they were not backed by evidence that really supported the conclusion. And the overarching conclusion of that book was that white rural Americans are the biggest threat to democracy. If that had been a conclusion that was solidly backed by existing data and research, legitimately, you know, I would have not necessarily liked the tone, but I wouldn't have, you know, that's how it is. That's science. That's social science. But because
we're not doing what maybe more conservative or right-wing media has done in reaction to this book and just sort of tutting at liberals, right?
Exactly. It's, you know,
there are real problems in American democracy.
Right. Well, yeah. And, you know, I'm a researcher. I'm a scholar. You know, if the evidence is there, then fine. But because it was not there, it comes across as just this diatribe against rural white Americans, right, which is something that's seen as okay, a group that's okay to hate on by certain segments of society. And so for me, with the research that they cited of mine, they cited a study where I found that people who more strongly identify as being from a rural area, they're less trusting of experts in science. And so the fact, there's sort of an irony in that, because the fact that they made this book, they wrote this book, you know, where it seems like their conclusions were formed and then they tried to find stuff to fill in to support it. And, you know, if you look closely, it doesn't really translate. In doing that, they're just inflaming this problem. They're just inflaming this sort of division between rural America, or this perception of being left behind, being disrespected, negatively stereotyped, and sort of forgotten by centers of power. And so that's what my big gripe with it is that you cite my research, you know, that finds that there's this really, you know, prominent division in terms of expertise in society versus, say, rural Americans who feel shut out from these sort of centers of expertise and power. And then you like do something to sort of inflame that. That was my big push, you know, in that article, and then sort of a call to say, you know, we as researchers, especially people who study, you know, social phenomenon, we have a responsibility, you know, not to sow those divisions, especially when there's no, you know, there's not a full solid piece of evidence, you know, not a conclusive evidence to say, you know, something derogatory,
right,
to have such a strong conclusion.
Well, this gets me to something. We at Pulaski are really interested in this idea of place-based democracy. We talk about heartlands, but I use heartland in this really dynamic way to be like, it's where place comes to the fore. So heartland can be Buffalo, and it can be Rochester, and it can be where I'm from, right? And I think that this is actually an interesting avenue to explore, because rural America is a national category, but there are like places that are rural where extremism is a problem. Northern Idaho is an example. Yeah. More specifically, I'm from the South. One of the first shows we did here, almost 3 years ago now, but was with Angie Maxwell, University of Arkansas, who wrote The Long Southern Strategy. And something I struggle with as a Southerner is that, and this is not really just a rural thing, but a Southern problem, which is I, despite the affection I have for my region, am a bit of a pessimist about the fact that I'm not really convinced that a strong commitment to liberal democracy ever emerged in the South. And that a lot of the problems here have just been endemic to the region kind of from the beginning and were never really resolved. And so attachments, you know, we do have, but it's not just rural communities. We just have a lot of problems in Southern politics with anti-democratic tendencies. Sheriffs come into the equation as well. Jessica Pishko is one of our fellows, and she writes about sheriffs, and obviously that they exist outside the South, but particularly the role of sheriffs in the South of, you know, wielding justice sometimes in a fairly not even arbitrary, but very intentional manner that distorts the course of criminal justice is a real problem. And so I think one of the things that's interesting to me is how could this be placed in a way that you know, rural is such a big national category. And we talked at the beginning of this about how hard it is to even define rural. But there are regions where we see real problems emerging. And I think that, you know, where I'm from does have a lot of that, right? Like there's some serious challenges in, say, Arkansas politics. I don't know about with people being politically violent, but I would say it is disturbing to me the history in a lot of ways here, but then also the current willingness to support you know, even though it's split along partisan lines and there are other explanatory variables there, at the end of the day, you know, there's still pretty overwhelming support for a person running for president again who tried to overthrow the government.
Yeah, so you're sort of thinking, you know, like, how do we sort of capture who these groups are? I guess, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there are potentially ways to capture those individuals. You know, but to say it's like rural specific or white rural, I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, even outside of the South, you mentioned law enforcement. You know, I'm from Minnesota, which had a huge problem in the Minneapolis Police Department with the police union being absolutely corrupt.
Right.
You know, that's what led to not just the shooting in, you know, 2020, or the I guess killing of in 2020, but also there were previous in the Twin Cities, previous shootings of, you know, there'd be a white cop shooting an innocent black man. Right. So, you know, that's just one example. You know, going back to that idea of January 6th, supporters, you know, again, a lot of those people were from places you would think would be solidly blue. You know, so I think when it comes to geography, especially since the dynamics are strange now in our current era, because we're in an era of nationalized politics. So that means that a lot of the sort of ways people think about things are very much nationalized across the country. But we still see these sort of local and like, you know, state-based tendencies. And some of that, I think, does have to do with just how people sort of sort themselves, combined with some of these long-standing, you know, historical precedents. So, yeah, there's a lot of complicated things into the mix when it comes to trying to understand, you know, in a particular place, why are we having these sets of attitudes and not elsewhere? Yeah, I guess. I don't know if that's like a satisfactory like response to that, but I think just going I'll say this. I think maybe a lot of times when people, going back to the definition of rural, when people say rural, I think sometimes they just mean, you know, places that like politically might be different from them or have sort of a different approach. And so I think sometimes people say, well, like, you know, Arkansas, they'll sort of think in their mind, oh, rural, but it's just like they're different is kind of what happens.
And as that nationalized politics and those dynamics emerge, right, you see even more of a split in the state. And that gets also what you're talking about, which is like, yeah, there's an urban rural split in terms of political politics or partisanship, but there's also like the suburbs and the exurbs are very different from Little Rock proper, right, in terms of how, you know, conservative they are, etc. And so those dynamics also play out inside the state in a way that, right, like that definition when you're throwing it out nationally doesn't really capture.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say, too, the South is different also when it comes to urban rural in a lot of places. I mean, it's different generally. Yeah. But it's even when it comes to urban rural politics, it's also very different. So South Carolina, if you look at a map of like an election map of South Carolina in 2020, it's like the colors aren't like neatly, you know, along the gradient of urban rural, like, say, Minnesota. Yep. It is all over the place. You know, you have Myrtle Beach, which is solidly red. You have suburbs of Columbia, which are solidly red. You have a bunch of rural, like very rural counties that are blue.
We have that too, because some of our most rural counties in the Delta are also some of the blackest counties in Arkansas.
And they're so very, I was going to say,
yeah,
in the South, a lot of times it goes more along racial lines as opposed to urban rural. Which, you know, that also complicates the picture. When people talk about the rural South, you know, that a lot of times means not white. But there's a sort of stereotype in people's minds that they're calling up. And so that also gets at one of my big sometimes pet peeves, is that we automatically associate rural with being white. Mm-hmm. And this is going back to the White Rural Rage book, I mean, a lot of times when the authors cite rural stuff, you know, like in rural counties, we found this or whatever, they automatically think that means white rural people,
right.
You know, whether that be, you know, a normatively like positive or negative thing, there's no analysis of, or it completely forgets many times that there are non-whites. Now there is a chapter, or they do take a chapter to talk about rural non-whites.
Right.
But throughout the rest of the book, it's just sort of like there's no distinction when you have to, methodologically, you should break those out if you can.
And otherwise, even just the dynamics, right? Like Tyler, he's up in Maine.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I have other friends in Maine, and Maine is interesting. Maine is in some ways developed like Arkansas, very rural with a few centers, not big cities. At the same time, Maine is, alongside Vermont, one of the least religious states in the country. I'm from an incredibly religious state, one of the top five. And so suddenly you have very different, right? Like what centers rural life in places where it is predominantly the church versus places where that's not an anchoring center. And that matters, right? Especially with all the people love to talk about Christian nationalism, and it's a real thing that is that's a problem for American democracy, but obviously, like, you know, you can't really compare the institutions and structures that are sort of centering people's lives, even if they are conservative people, in rural Maine versus, say, rural Arkansas or rural Alabama.
Yeah, the structure is completely different. Even who's there is very different. So you might say, well, you know, there's a good chunk of rural white people in Arkansas, and there's a good chunk of rural white people in Maine. Those are not always the same, you know, like background, outlook in life, how they structure their lives, which institutions they're part of. A lot of times very different. Maine is weird because it's such a, Vermont's an extremely weird state because it is, if not the most rural state, like the second most. And yet it is reliably blue.
And they have Bernie Sanders. They
you know, a self-described democratic socialist.
Yeah.
And it's because a lot of the people who live in rural Maine, like one generation, those people or one or maybe two generations before were living in big urban centers, and they just decided to leave. So that's, again, sort of pointing to that socialization and that sort of over time, you know, grew up and then left, and bringing your attitudes with you. That sort of happened in the reverse when it comes to Vermont. If you think about Maine, a lot of people who have, you know, are wealthier, let's say in Boston, they'll get a second like summer home on the coast of Maine, and then they'll just retire there. And that's a big thing. You know, you see that happening sort of again in the mountain states. I talked about this a little bit ago, but that a lot of times, you know, changes that whole dynamic. And then who shows up there, you know, who votes, what that looks like, how, you know, what the small towns look like. You know, it's going to be, if you're the people around there are used to like the amenities of city life, you're going to start having more like, you know, boutique coffee shops and like really nice restaurants, you know, and that's going to look very different than like rural white South, where that's, the churches are the institutions that everyone surrounds themselves with, you know, and there's the local barbecue joint or whatever, you know, whatever else you have, the local bar joint, whatever. Very different sorts of social structures happening.
Yeah. I mean, I love all this. And even talking about like these distinctions, plus like the thing we were talking about earlier with Black versus white rural residents, it makes me think of like, it's like 6 or 7 years old now, the Adam Driver SNL sketch. Where he's like the northern guy at like a Klan meeting, or is that like a Klan, but like white national, and they're all like, we want to go somewhere just for the, he goes, you're just for the white people, where everybody lives in pure like rural happy. And he goes, you're so Vermont, and they're like, no, that's in the north. He goes, you're describing Vermont. like we want to go somewhere where you can't see a black person for miles, like Vermont. Like, and then like that's the gag. It's like he just gets me like, you're describing Vermont.
Right. Like one of the most left-leaning states. Yeah. So like,
and at the end, they're all like, we should go to Vermont and like try like, you know, artisan honey. Like,
the agriculture in Vermont is like the like organic, you know, small little farms with like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very crunchy, right? Whereas like, like it's and that's the other thing, right? There's that rural, like there's that like Green Acres kind of, it's rural because I'm doing this for my mental health and my wellness, and I am into like peace, love, and happiness, which is like not really Arkansas. But then we have this town called Eureka Springs, which is like this like little 2,000 something person town in the Ozarks that is very LGBTQ friendly. They tried to decriminalize weed there, like back in the like early 2000s. It's so known for this, like in the in Dope Sick, right? The Hulu series based off the pandemic, the epidemic with painkillers and opioids. The gay couple, the young girls, are dreaming of moving to Eureka Springs because they're like, it's just like West Virginia, but it's gay. and like that, and that's the thing. Eureka Springs is this little like queer town in the Ozarks that makes no sense in some ways, but it's, you know, it's like a staple of
absolutely. even where you think, you know, that wouldn't be a thing, there's right. There's overlap. That, you know, that reminds me of when I went to college. So I went to a small liberal arts college in rural Minnesota, which narrows it down. But I remember going, and I'm the daughter of like a corn and soybean farmers, you know, like small family farm. And so I remember I went to college and I saw that there was a farm club, and I was like, oh, this must be like 4-H or, you know, FFA or whatever. So I went, and it was a bunch of these like crunchy, you know, like hipsters at the time, like making their own kombucha, you know. I'm just like, what the fuck is this? I'm sorry if I shouldn't.
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I was just like, but that gives you also this idea of how people sort of like differently conceptualize like what farming life is like. And they're just like, you know, like totally, totally against the kind of farming my dad.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like in that too, part of it, because I was in college in the like mid to late 2000s, where the like hipster country thing had really kicked off with Old Crow. I genuinely do love Old Crow Medicine Show, but like, you know, this very like fusion of like, we're gonna do like Nashville, but like very hipstery and like a little crunchy as well, and like everybody's in suspenders and like like has like old fashioned pipes and stuff. You know, I think it kind of culminated with Mumford and Sons and them being like from the UK and stuff, but like that was there for a long time, right? And I was definitely around that and part of it, you know, because I was like, I love the South of the country music, and also you know, was a little 2000s hipster child at the same time. So it was like, hey, this is perfect for me. This is like every
it's like the
thing I grew up around is cool now. But no, it's a disorienting thing. Okay. So I wanted to bring us to our chatter question, which is always that we ask recommendation from your neck of the woods that can always be, especially when we have people who grew up in interesting places, and in addition to, you know, you now live and work in South Carolina, Minnesota or South Carolina, can be food, restaurant, culture, a state or national park, a museum, whatever it is. Just the thing where it's like, this isn't necessarily always on people's radar when they come to this place that they should check out.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you one from Columbia, where I'm currently at, South Carolina, and I'm going to give you one from Minnesota, where I grew up and lived much of my life. So the one in South Carolina is Congaree National Park. It is free, first of all. Most national parks are not. And it is one of the least visited, but it is a crime because it is really cool. They have a boardwalk going all the way around, and they have some of the tallest trees in the east side of the United States. And yeah, it's great. I was not expecting how cool it would be, so I very much recommend it. And then in Minnesota, I recommend the Voyageurs National Park in Boundary Waters Canoe Area. again, some of the least visited places in terms of parks that you can visit, but also very cool. You can canoe all the way through. So for people who are into national parks and going outdoors and stuff like that, both great places to visit.
Awesome. Dr. Kristin Lins Trujillo, you can find her work in a number of places, 538, other national magazines. Her most recent piece on this white rural rage is in Newsweek. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The Periphery is a production of the Pulaski Institution. I've been your host, Alan Elrod. Our music was written, recorded, and produced by Brandon Ragsdale and Cody Smith. Thank you for coming, and please join us next time.